The issues that matter most, right here. The Drew Mariani Show
on Relevant Radio.
For several hours overnight, as we learned of those explosions in Iran, there was significant concern of an all-out war erupting between Israel and Iran. But as the sun came up in the region, Iran started downplaying the attack, calling it very limited, and Israeli government and military officials not talking about it at all.
It's the Drew Mariani Show on Relevant Radio.
Good afternoon, friends. Welcome back. I'm Ed Morrissey of HotAir.com. I'm filling in for Drew Mariani today, taking your calls at 888-914-9149, 888-914-9149. Now, that clip was from ABC News that was reporting on the response from Israel to the massive rocket drone attack that Iran launched on Israel earlier in the week. Right now, it appears that both sides are standing pat, but this injects quite a bit of uncertainty into what's going on in the region, and clearly everyone's nerves are at a fine pitch there. In order to get a better grasp of what's going on here, we are joined today by Lieutenant Colonel Dakota Wood. He served for 20 years in the Marine Corps. He's now retired and is the owner CEO of Hot Gates Consulting, which is a boutique consultancy specializing in helping people better understand the rapidly evolving national security environment and its implications for America's security, economic, and diplomatic interests. And Colonel Wood, thank you so much for joining us today.
Ed, it's great to be with you. Finally got some talent on the air. That Drew Mariani guy, I don't know about him.
I'm his biggest fan, right? So, you know, I only come on here when I know he's not going to be here. So, and so
that's,
you know,
great team there.
It's a great team here all together, and I'm happy to be here because I get a chance to talk to you. Because this is a very complicated situation here. There's a lot of moving parts. Israel is basically fighting, in some aspects, a four-front war. You've got Hamas in Gaza. You've got Hezbollah in southern Lebanon. You've got the Houthis, who are trying to inject their presence from Yemen. And, of course, Iran is part of all three of those, because all three of those are proxies of the Iranian Islamic Republic, and their attack on Israel was unprecedented. They have, I don't believe, ever have directly attacked Israel in the past. They've always used their proxies to do it, and Israel has never had to return fire. I know that there was a lot of pressure on Israel to so-called take the win after having almost everything intercepted from the Iranian attack, but Israel clearly felt that it was necessary to restore some level of deterrence so that attack does not get repeated.
It's just about as complicated a situation as you could possibly imagine. In all of those areas, all of those actors, you know, Israel, Iran, Hamas, Hezbollah, the Houthis, you name it, they have their own internal, you call them domestic sorts of things. You know, in Israel, there are people who only want to get the hostages released from Hamas. There are folks who are kind of doves, is what they would be described. You know, they just do not want to get involved in any kind of conflict. And yet in the same cabinet, you have hawks, right, that say, hey, this was a lame counterstrike by Israel. They should have really taken the hurt, you know, downtown Tehran or whatnot. You know, what do you do with Hezbollah in southern Lebanon that's been launching rockets and kidnapping Israelis for 20 or 30 years now, right? And so, you know, and even in Iran, you know, they're worried about uprising. There have been domestically produced attacks against the regime. You know, if you remember the Arab Spring, you know, not too many years ago, and kind of how that spread across northern Africa and up into the Middle East. So all of these have domestic internal dynamics where they're trying to get, you know, glory and monetary support and news headlines, you know, trumpet for their cause. And yet if they go too far, they invite just a really aggressive, effective response from Israel or some other actor in that region. And so this continuous fear about a region-wide war that would be near impossible to stop, you know, once it really gets going, I think you characterized it really well. You know, just everybody's kind of on tenterhooks, right? I mean, it's just a really concern about this thing spiraling out of control. And so this very measured response, presumably Israel, you know, they're not claiming it. The U.S. is, you know, keeping a distance from it, but nobody is denying it. You know, perhaps it satisfied the hawks that you need to do something in response to 340-plus munitions, you know, delivered from Iran toward Israel, and you couldn't do nothing. I mean, you couldn't just absorb the blow because it might invite, you know, more attacks from more actors. So it's just a mess.
One of the issues, I think, that or one of the messages, let's say, that last night's attack sent, now that we have a better understanding of what it was, is that Israel can get around Iran's air defenses pretty easily. And Iran is pretty isolated. Nobody else is stepping up to help Iran protect its airspace in the same way that, you know, Israel not only has the U.S., but the U.K., France was involved in some of that defensive response to the Iranian attack, but yeah. So was Jordan and Saudi Arabia. So that's certainly one message that's sent there, but the other message is that apparently there was just a single point of attack. You hear some conflicting things on this. It's still a little ambiguous, but it looks like that was an attack by what looks like an airplane-launched cruise missile that traveled several hundred miles and hit, struck right in the heart of Iran. You know, Isfahan is almost in dead center Iran, and it where it hit is right next to where they have their main nuclear research facility. And it seems like to me what the Israelis were saying is, we can hit anywhere, anytime, and you're not going to be able to stop it. This is basically a proof of capability demonstration rather than a serious attempt to do damage. And that might have sent a message that will calm things down a little bit, at least for a while.
Yeah, near perfect defense, you know, against, again, 340 plus, only a few made it through. So you've got this shield, you know, of various types, directed energy, small, medium, and large anti-missile missiles that blunted that attack from Iran. And then all the things that you just said is being able to execute attack inside of Iran or into the interior of Iran. Isfahan is slightly west of dead center, it's south of Tehran. And so you have to go through either Saudi Arabia or Iraq if it's going to be an air-delivered munition, right? And there's some debate about that, right? Was it one missile? Was it a few? The Iranians are claiming that these were short-range drones, which would imply they have to be launched from inside of Iran. So even if that was the case, you have Israeli agents of some type, or you have a domestic group using this opportunity on behalf of Israel or their own things to launch an attack from inside of Iran, right? So if it's air delivered, how did the airplane get there? What aircraft was that? My guess would be an F-35, very low radar visibility on that thing, you know, near invisible, but, you know, if you fly it properly, you can evade all that stuff. And you're going against this airfield, which is plays host to the S-300 integrated air defense system, which is almost the best thing that Russia produces in this sort of defensive capability. It's extremely good at shooting down missiles and aircraft. So to deliver this strike in whatever way, from outside in or from inside, against an airfield co-located with a nuclear facility, and Isfahan is one of Iran's kind of crown jewels in terms of cities, about 2 million people, a huge number of mosques that are just brilliantly, you know, colored and tiled mosaics and all that stuff. So to effect an attack against that site in those conditions at that range, you know, what you were just talking about, you know, a demonstration of capability, and it's telling Iranian leadership, if you really want to go down this path, we will be able to hurt you much, much deeper and more painfully than anything you can do to us.
We are speaking with Lieutenant Colonel Dakota Wood, who served for 20 years in the Marine Corps, now retired, owner, CEO of Hot Gates Consulting, taking your calls at 888-914-9149, 888-914-9149. And I guess the question now is, and it's almost impossible to answer this with any high degree of certainty, but does that settle things between Israel and Iran in terms of direct response to each other? Does this go back to what had been sort of the doctrine of both countries, which was battling through proxies? I mean, it's no great secret that Iran has basically been at war with Israel since the radicals took over in 1979. They've also been at a low-level pitch of war against the United States over the exact same period of time for the exact same reasons. But they've been careful not to tweak that into a flat-out shooting war. They prefer to work through terrorist proxies until this week. And that was, I believe, what Israel was trying to get them back to, is to try to remind them that they really don't want to get into a direct war with either Israel or the United States or a combination of. But does it go back to the proxy war? Does Iran actually rethink some of that as well? Because the Israelis have been pretty good at picking off their IRGC commanders in places like Lebanon and in Syria. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think it goes back to proxy, right? So Hezbollah, Hamas, the Houthis, and others wouldn't have any capability at all were it not for Iran providing them advisory support, training, and the actual munitions themselves, you know, weapons and ammo and missiles and rockets and drones of all types, right? So that flow of munitions has not stopped. Iran hasn't called back its promise to destroy, you know, the little Satan, you know, to wipe Israel off the map and all those sorts of things. You know, they haven't pulled back from that at all. And so even to save face within the Islamic world in the great contest between Shia and Sunni, Iran, the Shia power, Persian power, really needs to look like it's strong and incapable, right? So it can't completely leave the field of battle. But I think what this does is it takes, for the time being, major conflict off the table and shifts it back into the shadows. And you know, you'll recall, Israel has been pretty effective at assassinations of Iranian scientists inside Iran. They've effected sabotage of some of the nuclear facilities, either kinetic or using cyber attacks to mess with centrifuges and all that. And they've been remarkably successful at targeting Iranian senior general officers, military officers, who provide support to these terrorist groups when these generals travel outside of Iran proper. So kind of more direct from Israel's standpoint, that it doesn't really have any options. I mean, it doesn't have, you know, minions or proxies or what have you in the region to work through. It has to do it on its own, whereas it's the opposite for Iran. Iran has a half a two dozen different types of groups that can do its bidding, because it enhances the profile and the funding that these little groups get, you know, from siding with Iran and conducting attacks against Israel. So I think it goes back into the shadows, and the prospect for major war has been paused or delayed, put off into the near future for a while.
And Colonel Wood, you mentioned that, you know, Israel doesn't have proxies. It has to do it all itself. That's very true. But what does it say when Jordan and Saudi Arabia join in a defense of Israel? I mean, this is kind of the fruit of the effort in the previous administration, the Abraham Accord, and to the credit of this administration, they've been trying to, you know, maintain that, move that forward as well. But is that the kind of game changer that might force Iran to rethink its hegemony in that area, or attempt at hegemony in that area? Because it's really just, if there's an alliance between Jordan, Saudi Arabia, Egypt to some degree, and some of the other Sunni Arab nations in the region, Iran really only has Syria, which is a regime that they're barely propping up, Lebanon, which they're not even propping that up. Hezbollah is just one party in that system, and then maybe Qatar, although Qatar is supposed to be a sort of like the Casablanca, if you will, the Rick's Cafe American of the Middle East.
Well, I do think that it's this larger regional context, and in any one of those countries, the cases you mentioned, it's useful to ask the question, what do they gain or lose, right?
Right.
So it's not just Saudi Arabia, Egypt, Jordan, Iran, what have you, vis-a-vis Israel. It's if there is a large war in the region, does Saudi Arabia lose in some way? You know, does it disrupt energy markets? Is it able to get its gas and oil, you know, out to market? You know, it would be in the middle of these two warring powers, you know, shooting rockets and missiles and aircraft and all that kind of good stuff in the area. So does Saudi Arabia come out ahead? You know, and the same question then for Syria and Turkey and Jordan and others in that particular region. On the Islam and the Muslim world side, Shia versus Sunni, right? So does
right.
Saudi Arabia gain if Iran is hurt in some way? And so kind of, you know, the enemy of my enemy is my friend, right? Does Saudi Arabia improve its domestic stability, economic vitality, and its prominence in that world if it seeks a loose, you know, kind of weird friendship, not friendship, but partnering with Israel in limited instances, when it is actually in a larger theological, ideological, political confrontation with Iran, you know, again, Sunni versus Shia. So it's again, it's this multi-layered, very complicated set of factors where each of those governments is constantly calculating its own domestic political, you know, its social stability, its economic stability, vitality. Does it gain or lose in getting involved in a war, you know, that's very expensive? There's been some estimates that in defending against that 340 munitions attack, it was roughly $1 billion, right? Some of the missiles fired off of U.S. ships in the Red Sea to shoot down some of the munitions heading toward Israel were $12 million apiece, $12 million a missile, right? The other ones they've been using are $2 to $3 million. So there are all these calculations going on and how it helps the governments involved maintain or improve their military, economic, and political stability with respect to their national interests. And how those play out, I think the decisions made on a day-to-day basis.
We're again speaking with Lieutenant Colonel Dakota Lieutenant Colonel Dakota Wood, yeah. Who served for 20 years in the Marine Corps. Sorry about that. Singular, not plural. He is now the owner and CEO of Hot Gates Consulting, and we're talking about what's going on in the Middle East, taking your calls at 888-914-9149. Let's talk about what happens now with Hamas, because this is the war that has actually been hot, right? This is the ground war. Mm-hmm. This is an air war. It's been going on for over 6 months now, and it's been more or less sort of stalled as there's a larger debate over what to do in regards to the last bastion of Hamas's last four organized brigades in Rafah. Mm-hmm. And you mentioned Saudi Arabia and Jordan and in what the Sunni Arab countries that are aligning with Israel are hoping to gain out of this. And Hamas is part of that encirclement strategy that is not just targeting Israel, but also targeting Saudi Arabia and the other Sunni Arab yeah. nations. I mean, the Houthis are clearly there to put pressure on Saudi Arabia, and Hamas would be the same thing. Syria is part of that. Do you think that they are going to sotto voce say, let's just get it over with in Rafah now that Iran seems to be back in the box? Or do you think that they're going to be looking for some other way out?
Well, the news cycle jumps from one headline to the next. So everybody
yes,
kind
does.
Of breathes a sigh of relief that the prospect of a much larger war has kind of been bypassed. But when you've got an empty headline banner, if Israel decides to move into Rafah, and you see, you know, a million get additional displaced personnel or large casualties on the civilian side, that's going to dominate headlines again, right? So,
right.
you know, no rest for the weary in this sort of thing. But yeah, you're right. The encirclement going where Iranian-sponsored groups have this big crescent going from Iran through parts of Iraq down through Syria and then into Lebanon and Gaza Strip and even the West Bank is concerned for the Sunni or the Arab powers in that area. You know, for all the criticism that Israel gets about not letting civilians into Israel proper or opening up corridors for humanitarian relief, the Gaza Strip has a southern border with Egypt, right? So why is it
right.
Egypt allowing the flow in and out. It's because Hamas is an offshoot of the Muslim Brotherhood. The Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt has posed a significant threat to the ruling Egyptian authorities, and so they don't want to increase their own problems right here at home, which then emphasizes this point we're making about domestic issues really drive foreign policy decisions and actions. And so when you look at that, you know, that landscape of all these competing powers, you know, Saudi Arabia backs the government of Yemen. The Houthis have been able to displace the government of Yemen. It's now, you know, in exile. And so the Houthis are acting on behalf of Iran is a mechanism to push back, you know, their rivals, Saudi, Arab, Sunni, you know, Muslim powers, you know, in the region. And so why in the world would the Houthis want to attack Israel? They're not part of that immediate fight. Well, because it does Iran's bidding. They get more support and, you know, pats on the back from Iran, and it improves their ability, the Houthis' ability, to continue waging conflict, you know, there in Yemen, right? So it can show right. this sequence of relationships and actions and how one act might serve two or three different interests, right? So, again, it's another aspect of complexity. And if your government in Jerusalem, you're having to account for a very restive neighborhood where most people don't want you there. They don't want you to even exist, you know, this river to the sea nonsense. Right. And so for Israel, all of these things truly are existential, you know, an overused word here in the West. But for Israel, you know, a small country, few people, ringed by folks who don't want you in that neighborhood, you know, these are the kinds of factors that influence their decision making.
So, Colonel Wood, what do you expect to see happen in regards to Rafah at this point in time? And I know this is, I'm not asking you to make a prediction that we're going to, you know,
sure.
Yeah, just speculative, just, the, you know, the more likely next steps in Rafah. Do you expect to see Israel try to complete the destruction of Hamas, or do you expect some diplomatic solution to intervene here?
I think Hamas will make its own worst case for itself. If they won't be able to resist continuing to strike out at Israel, that will give Prime Minister Netanyahu an excuse or the rationale or justification for continuing, you know, their war against Hamas. I mean, again, you know, Hamas hasn't renounced its objective of killing Jews, you know, destroying Israelis, destroying the country of Israel. So, you know, they've had to kind of pay attention to Iran here. Israel has the last week or so because of that big missile barrage. But give it a few days, and I think the Netanyahu government will return back to that particular town on the near the Egyptian border. So they can't just step back and say, we're going to pause for a month or two and see what Hamas does. I think Hamas has been licking its wounds, rebuilding its strength, and will probably do something absolutely stupid and conduct another attack of some type against Israel and Israeli forces. And so Israel will have to respond to that. They just cannot let Hamas go unanswered, right, or uncontrolled, right, left to its own devices, because they don't want to see a repeat of October 7th. I mean, that is seared deeply into the Israeli psyche, and they just cannot allow that to happen. Netanyahu took a lot of criticism about how could this have happened, you know, given the sprawling apparatus of their intelligence community.
Indeed.
And military preparedness and stuff. And so he can't allow that to happen. Now, how do you handle that? How do you maintain the goodwill of the United States, of the Biden administration, you know, who also is very fearful, very risk averse, doesn't want to see a war kick off, especially in the midst of a domestic, you know, presidential cycle, right? So Biden gets this drug into another war in the Middle East. They don't want that headline, but they can't keep Netanyahu, you know, cornered in a box as well. He's got his own domestic pressures. You know, do you go in more aggressively to destroy Hamas, or do you pull back, hope that Hamas releases all the hostages, in which case Hamas wouldn't have any leveraging, you know, abilities, no chips to play in that. And so, again, it's going to be a day-to-day thing. A lot of pressure for humanitarian relief. We'll see whether the international community helps or hurts in that. The UN, what, half of its condemnations over the last 20 years have been directed at Israel, you know, more than all other countries combined. So I don't know that UN has been a great supporter of Israel, you know, at all. So
exactly.
Again, it's Israel on its own, and they're having to deal with their security situation almost on an hourly basis.
Lieutenant Colonel Dakota Wood is the owner and CEO of Hot Gates Consulting. He's often a guest right here, and you just spent the last half hour understanding why. A great discussion, lots of great insight. Colonel Wood, thank you so much for your time.
A blessing to me. Thank you very much for having me on.
Thank you, sir. When we come back, we're going to be talking with Ellen Fantini, the managing editor of the European Conservative, about issues of free speech and freedom of religion in Europe and why we in America should be paying attention. I'm Ed Morrissey, filling in for Drew Mariani. We'll be right back.
Your news, the Drew Mariani Show on Relevant Radio. Your news now. Sponsor of the University of Dallas, the Catholic University for Independent Thinkers, invites high school juniors, seniors, and recent graduates to study the great books this summer at UD's two-week-long Arete program while earning 3 hours of college credit. Info at relevantradio.com/UDallas.
Trying to stay up on the headlines? The Drew Mariani Show is here for you.
The Drew Mariani Show on Relevant Radio.
It's 32 minutes past the hour. I'm Ed Morrissey of HotAir.com, filling in for Drew today, taking your calls at 888-914-9149. We got a call from a listener on a different topic during the last segment asking about the assisted suicide legislation that has been introduced in the Illinois General Assembly. That is SB 3499. And it is a assisted suicide legislation, euthanasia legislation. If you oppose that, and of course, as Catholic doctrine says, we should, you need to get in touch. If you're in Illinois, you need to get in touch with your legislator, state legislator, excuse me. A phone call can be a very fast, very immediate way to communicate your position on an issue or to find out what your legislator's position is on it. So you want to contact the state of Illinois at 217-782-2000 or 312-814-3500 to get the specific numbers for members of the General Assembly, or you can go to www.ilga.gov. That's ilga.gov. That's how you can make sure that you get your chance to get your feedback in on the assisted suicide legislation that has been introduced into the Illinois state legislature. At this point, though, we're going to change gears, and we're going to take a look at what's going on in Europe on freedom of speech and freedom of religion. And joining us to discuss two very disturbing cases there is Ellen Fantini. She is the managing editor of the European Conservative, the leading alternative publication in Europe, which is based in Brussels, which is actually the site of one of the issues that we're going to be talking about. You can find them at europeanconservative.com. Ellen, welcome to the show.
Thanks so much for inviting me.
And thank you so much. I know that this is very late for you, so I do appreciate your coming on the show here. First off, tell us a little bit about European Conservative, the magazine.
Sure. So we are a quarterly magazine on politics, art, beauty, culture, opinion. But we also have a website, a daily website, news, commentary, analysis, essays, and we host events in Brussels and around Europe to look at what's happening on the right.
And so, I mean, this is it's about the right, it's for the right, and this is, you know, conservatives in Europe who are, you know, a little bit more beleaguered than perhaps here in the United States, although conservatives in the United States feel pretty beleaguered here as well. It's we got a little taste of what you're going through in Brussels. Tell us a little bit about what happened when there was a convention of conservatives in the city of Brussels.
Sure. So maybe your listeners have heard of the National Conservatism Conference, also known as NatCon. It happens in America as well as here in Europe. And it's been in the planning stages for months and was set to take place in Brussels on Tuesday and Wednesday of this week. On Friday last week, so 1 week ago, the organizers learned from the venue that they were going to be canceled. In other words, deplatformed. The venue wouldn't hold the event there. And this was because the mayor of Brussels, a socialist, put political pressure on the owners of the venue. And the owners of the venue finally announced that they were pulling out. So, as you can imagine, the Edmund Burke Foundation and the other co-organizer, MCC Brussels, had to scramble to try to find a venue, a second venue, at a moment's notice, with 500 participants and speakers, yeah, including current and former prime ministers, party leaders, members of the European Parliament, political philosophers, journalists. This was no small feat. So they were able to turn it around, and they found a venue and were getting organized there. And then on Monday the 15th, the day before the conference was to begin, the replacement venue, the Sofitel, which is owned by an enormous corporate entity, the Accor Group, broke its contract with the organizers, saying that they wouldn't hold the conference either. And they cited objections from the European Council officials, who also set to stay at the hotel. And then the mayor of this district of Brussels boasted to the media that he was also responsible for this cancellation. So in other words, taking political credit for silencing his political opponents. So,
I mean, you know, can I read the mayor's statement for our listeners?
Please do.
Because this is, and be sure to have your fainting couches ready, folks, because these were the grounds on which the mayor shut down NatCon. Considering that on the website of the conference in question, this mission is summarized as follows: the past and future of conservatism are inextricably tied to the idea of the nation, to the principle of national independence, and to the revival of unique national traditions that alone have the power to bind a people together and to bring about them flourishing, which is misspelled in the mayor's statement. That this mission is not only ethically conservative, e.g. hostility to the legalization of abortion, same-sex unions, etc., but also focused on the defense of, quote, national sovereignty, which implies, among other things, a Eurosceptic attitude. Well, and again, we're speaking with, I'm sorry, I'm trying not to laugh, but we're speaking with Ellen Fantini of EuropeanConservative.com. I mean, this bill of particulars reads like, I don't know, pretty much an evening at the Elks here in the United States. I mean, this is not radical stuff here. This is fairly routine conservatism.
Well, let's have your listeners stay on their fainting couches, because that was the mayor shutting it down at the third venue. So venues before canceled, one of them the night before the conference was to begin. We find a third venue, and then we have the wonderful owner of that venue working through the night to get us ready for this conference. We have Nigel Farage, who is not only the former leader of the Brexit Party and a personality on GB News, he was on the stage when the police came to shut it down, holding the order of the mayor you just read. So it took two venues to cancel, and then a third venue who actually said yes to us, then the mayor tried to shoot it down. And he didn't even try to hide, as you pointed out, Ed, that this was politically motivated. In fact, he tweeted after the police came, saying that he issued an order to ban the National Conservatism Conference to guarantee public safety, and that the far right isn't welcome. Now, of course, it's all a pretext, as is very clear. Obviously, it's a conservative conference, a peaceful conservative conference with mainstream conservative leaders talking about mainstream conservative things like national sovereignty, like protection of human life, like draining the swamps of European capitals. It was just incredible.
You know, and again, we're speaking with Ellen Fantini of European Conservative, and you can find that at EuropeanConservative.com, by the way, and talking about this. First off, the mayor of Brussels I'm a little surprised that the mayor of Brussels has the authority to simply shut down conferences, even if it's in his own city, on the basis of speech. And again, you know, of course, in the United States, that wouldn't happen. Or would it? Because what he was using was the heckler's veto mechanism of safety. It was not safe for people to hear from heterodox, ideas, heterodox ideas such as pro-life, pro-traditional marriage, Euroscepticism, the idea of national sovereignty, which is, of course, part of the whole Brexit thing that Nigel Farage was part of. And I've interviewed Nigel Farage a couple of times. He's an interesting guy. Interesting to watch speak. He's a very sharp, witty kind of guy. Even if you don't agree with him, he's not really selling. You know, he's not really selling Nazism. What he's selling is just basically what we would call here in the United States federalism, or you could call it subsidiarity, which is, you know, trying to make sure that power remains as close to the actual people being governed as possible, rather than extended all the way across the English Channel in the case of the British.
Right.
I mean, those are fairly mainstream types of thoughts. They may not be, you know, majority opinions, but they're mainstream. And the way to deal with that is to have the debate. And if that position isn't going to gain followers, then you don't really have anything to worry about. You know, and I've been working on a concept called progressive fragility for a while, just in my mind.
Great.
And this is sort of this is a real example of this, is that rather than deal with the arguments being made, even maybe just show up and ask the National Conservatism Conference, would you accept a rebuttal speaker? Could we present a rebuttal speaker? And let's have a debate with Nigel Farage on stage. I bet you, slightly knowing Nigel Farage, he'd actually probably love that. He'd probably put two chairs out on the stage and have a debate, but they don't want to do that. And they don't even want people to hear the argument. And again, we're not talking about Nazism, even though, we're not talking about that. We're talking about mainstream conservatism as applied in the European context. And I just find it amazing that they won't even let people have the conversation amongst themselves.
Well, exactly. So essentially what the mayor was trying to say is that because people outside the event might not like what's being said inside the event, they might protest, and that's the public safety concern. But of course, that's an absurd legal basis, both in Europe and in the United States. You simply can't shut something down because other people might not like it. And his obvious pretext was laid bare by all of the things that he said, as you pointed out. I mean, the point is that so many of these so-called liberal, progressive, left-wing politicians really just want to use the laws to shut down their political or ideological opponents. And I'll tell you one little detail that will shock your audience. So as the police stood outside the venue, they wouldn't let anyone in. Speakers like elected members of the European and British parliaments, leaders of political parties were forced to stand outside in the rain. But even Cardinal Gerhard Mueller, former prefect of the Congregation for the Doctrine of the Faith was forced to stand outside by the police. He was not let into the building. It was shocking.
And even the lawyers for the Edmund Burke Foundation were prevented from being, you know, which was part part of the NatCon thing. I mean, they were blocking the lawyers from even getting in to deal with the issue that police were creating. They were literally creating the safety issue that they were citing as a reason to shut this down. And that's, again, a demonstration of the fragility of the EU governing elite, and specifically located in Brussels. We're speaking with Ellen Fantini of EuropeanConservative.com. When we come back, I want to talk about a case that may hit a little closer to home for Relevant Radio listeners. It has to do with whether or not quoting the Bible is actually a form of hate speech. I'm Ed Morrissey, filling in for Drew Mariani. We'll be right back.
Insight and analysis right here. It's the Drew Mariani Show. Relevant Radio.
This is your last chance to accompany Father Rocky on a Relevant Radio pilgrimage to Poland and Prague in September. Very limited spots are available. Departing from Chicago and San Francisco airports only, reserve your spots now at relevantradio.com/Poland. That's relevantradio.com/Poland.
Pray, hope, and don't worry. This is the Drew Mariani Show on Relevant Radio. The Chaplet of Divine Mercy, coming up next.
It's 50 minutes past the hour. I'm Ed Morrissey of HotAir.com, filling in for Drew Mariani today, and we are speaking, having a great conversation with Ellen Fantini, the managing editor of the European Conservative, the leading alternative publication in Europe, which is based in Brussels. You can find them at EuropeanConservative.com. We were talking about the mayor of Brussels shutting down the National Conservatives Conference in Brussels. That was earlier this week. Now we're going to switch to a different issue, but sort of the same problem, which is in Finland, where Finland Supreme Court apparently has ruled today that prosecutors will get a third opportunity to prosecute, and I'm never going to get this name right, Ellen, I apologize, I'm going to butcher it, but Päivi Räsänen, a member of the Parliament of Finland, can be prosecuted for writing a pamphlet about biblical marriage and questioning whether her denomination should really be supporting a pride event, and tweeting out apparently pictures of Bible verses in support of what we would consider traditional marriage. That apparently is enough to get her prosecuted now a third time. This is one of the reasons why national conservatism is probably a pretty good idea in Europe, and EuropeanConservative.com is a pretty good idea, is to make sure that these cases are getting scrutinized.
That's exactly right. Well, it certainly has been a very busy week for ADF International. Your listeners may be familiar with Alliance Defending Freedom.
Absolutely.
The legal advocacy organization. So ADF International is Alliance Defending Freedom in Europe and around the world. And Paul Coleman, who is the director of ADF International, was both at the National Conservatism Conference, helping his team to lead the defense there. But then as soon as he caught his breath, he found out that his client, Päivi Räsänen, was to stand trial a third time for expressing her Christian beliefs on marriage and sexuality 5 years ago. And, of course, Americans will be shocked to even think that there could be retrials after acquittals, because that's unheard of. But here the prosecution is getting a third bite at the apple. And what's particularly shocking to me is that the basis of the trial is for, quote, agitation against a minority group, which is a form of criminal hate speech that in Finnish law falls under the heading of war crimes and crimes against humanity.
My goodness.
My goodness is right. So this is the former interior minister of Finland. She's a long-standing parliamentarian. She's a grandmother. She was objecting in her personal capacity to her own church's involvement in a pride parade, pointing out that pride is a sin. And for this, she's been brought through 5 years of investigations, trials, personal harassment, professional degradation. It's just shocking. It's shocking to anyone who hears it.
It's amazing. And you know what this reminds me of? Is it basically reminds me of the way that cults deal with heretics. Right.
Exactly. Exactly. I mean, right.
This is a religion, right? I'm not just including the LGBTQIA+, whatever it is, because that's only part of it. It's not the only part of this sort of progressive cult. And you know, we were just talking about progressive fragility. This is one step above that. It's not just about shutting down a conference. It's about using criminal law to punish people who disagree with you, who have a religious point of view that's different than yours. You know, and Ellen, I think we like to think that we live in an enlightened age where we allow people, and certainly in the United States, I think we're better at this than in most places, where we allow people to worship God the way that they will worship God without, as long as it doesn't do violence to other people. And to hold different opinions and to espouse different opinions. But we have a constitutional bulwark that protects us in those exercises. And even that is under attack here in the United States, the First Amendment, which protects both speech and freedom of religious expression. And we're constantly defending that. Alliance Defending Freedom does a great job here in the United States doing that. And I think, you know, a lot of us here in the United States, we look at these cases and we're saying, you know, slippery slopes and, you know, this is disaster. And it is, because it leads to this.
Well, it is.
What's going on in Finland.
That's right. And I mean, one of the reasons why the European Conservative exists is to help English speakers all around the world understand what's happening in Europe. So half our audience, in fact, is based in America. And these cautionary tales, these tales of censorship and hate speech laws and, let's say, woke blasphemy and heresy trials, these are all warnings to Americans that they have to protect their freedoms, and reminders to Europeans that they have a choice to protect their own freedoms. So in June, there will be elections for the European Parliament, and Europeans are notoriously lukewarm about voting. But these kinds of cases that interfere with fundamental freedoms should remind people that the stakes are high. And frankly, we think that all of these politicians who support censorship and hate speech, they should be tossed out in the rain and have the doors locked behind them.
Yeah, I mean, certainly what we want to say is, you know, we want people to be able to express themselves no matter what. That includes progressives, too. It includes atheists. You know, honestly, atheists are,
absolutely,
to some extent, more tolerant than what we're seeing here in Finland. I mean, this is very, very authoritarian unto totalitarian, right? Where you are basically recreating the lives of the martyrs. This is sort of a soft martyrdom in this particular case, but you're basically recreating the lives of the martyrs here in an era where we are supposed to be enlightened enough to tolerant enough to be able to live together, regardless of what our belief systems are. And I think we lose sight of the fact that tolerance, first off, has to be pretty clearly defined, because what we're seeing here is clearly not tolerance, but also it is a very, very fragile thing. And as soon as people see an incentive for power, tolerance goes out the window. And that's exactly what's going on here.
That is exactly what's going on here. And I think people of goodwill, believers or not, should be shocked. Their conscience should be shocked that expressing one's deeply held religious beliefs is a crime in any Western country, anywhere in the world.
Yeah, it's amazing. It's absolutely amazing. Yeah, and again, we're speaking with Ellen Fantini of EuropeanConservative.com. And tell us a little bit more about European Conservative. We started off with this. We should end up with it as well, how people can find it and where, you know, what they can expect to get from it. We've got about 30 seconds.
Sure. So as I said, we report news every single day on our website, EuropeanConservative.com. We have opinion, we have commentary, we have essays, analysis. You can follow us on Twitter. We're at EuroConOfficial. And you can find out what's happening in Europe from a right-wing perspective.
And why it's going to wash up on the shores of America at some point in time, because that's
exactly what, right.
That's how this works. Ellen Fantini, thank you so much for spending some time with us this afternoon. Again, the website is EuropeanConservative.com, and check everything out there. Coming up next, the Chaplet of Divine Mercy. I'm Ed Morrissey, filling in for Drew Mariani. Stay tuned.